We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to AM 580 Focus, or Focus 580 here on WILL. I'm your guest host today, Chris Harris, filling in for David Inge. And with us today, we're doing our monthly topic, which is home maintenance. And we have our regular guest, Scott Spies from Spies Home Inspection Service. Hello, Scott. Welcome back.
Hi, Chris. Good to be here.
Right. Well, we're talking a little bit before the show started. It is now September. And so what do you suggest people need to start thinking about right now with their house?
Well, I figure a lot of people are already thinking, hey, it's got just a little chillier out here. Maybe I ought to start looking into the furnace. So that is actually probably a pretty good idea before the furnace guys get really carried away and overbooked, and have somebody come out and take a look at the furnace and make sure that it's ready for our heating season. Hopefully it's going to be several weeks yet before we get any really cold temperatures. But good clean filter in the furnace. Have the furnace checked if it hasn't been checked in the last couple of years. A lot of the older furnaces you may want to actually consider doing replacement on. We've got a lot newer, higher efficiency furnaces available on the market nowadays. Furnaces in the 90 to 95% efficiency range.
Right.
If you've got an older furnace, say 1970s or 1980s, you could be down in the 75 to 78% range. And so there is some energy savings and gains to be seen by putting in a newer unit. So if you've got an older one, have it checked out. If there's any problems, I'd probably have it replaced. If you've got a newer one, probably not a bad idea to have them checked about every 2 to 3 years, just to make sure everything's working properly.
And I guess the other upside with a furnace right now, especially if you have to replace one with a high efficiency one, is there are all sorts of different tax credits that you might be eligible for. So I've heard so it sounds like this, if you're in that situation where you got to replace a furnace, which is never good news, but this might be a good time to have some bad news.
Well, and it's always, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. It's one of those things where right now we don't really need the furnace, but it's a whole lot easier to check it and make sure it's working now than it is to wait until we get a first good temperature drop and all of a sudden it doesn't seem to be working and we got to now pay emergency calls to get things repaired. But also, as we can see by our beautiful weather this morning, a little bit of rain, precipitation, not a bad idea to get out there and do another gutter cleaning. The fall leaves are going to start coming out. The gutter is going to block up pretty quick. So we need to make sure that the gutters are clean enough that the water is going to get out and away from the house so that we don't have the wet basements and wet crawl space problems. Never like to see any of the downspouts stopping right at the corners of the house. I like to see them extended out at least 3 to 5 feet away from the house so we don't end up with soil settlement or even foundation settlement due to saturated soils. So all sorts of little things that we can get ready to do for our fall cleaning.
All right. Again, this is Focus 580, our monthly session of home maintenance with Scott Spies. And we certainly welcome your calls, 333-9455 locally or 800-222-9455. And it looks like we do, in fact, have a caller on line four coming up. Hello, line four.
Hello. Got a question. Have you heard of asphalt roof shingles infused with a copper powder?
No, I can't say that I'm familiar with that. I could understand that the copper powder would be used for basically an algicide as the acidity and the rain and such that we get around here hits the copper. It will create a little bit of a copper sulfide that will, or copper sulfate that will run down the shingles and help reduce any plant growth.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not familiar with them doing that at this point in time, but I could see where it would be a nice feature.
I just got a new roof of it and wondered what you thought.
I think it would be a great idea because, let's face it, as chemicals become more and more in the spotlight and the EPA keeping track of what's going on, that's one thing that we can do to help reduce plant and algae growth on the shingles and help extend the life of the shingles that hasn't been banned yet.
Yeah, you see those black streaks on almost every roof that slopes north.
Yeah, so no, I'm not aware of those, but I appreciate you calling and let me know. So now I'll see if I can take a look and see what kind of a record they've got for those.
Let me ask you, why do the pipes, in fact, I think the whole plumbing in the house, buzz when I run the tap?
Usually, if you've got a buzzing or a humming, it means we've got something vibrating or fluctuating. Usually, we'll find that in one of the valves, either a shutoff valve or could actually be in the faucet. One of the rubber washers is probably out of shape just a little bit, and as the water runs by it, it fluctuates and it kind of sends off a harmonics or a vibration through the water, which, of course, is a hydraulic fluid and basically vibrates all the piping in the house. Is it just one faucet or is it every faucet?
It's almost every faucet, and especially the toilet.
Okay, so it's probably on the cold water side somewhere. Could even be as far back as at the meter, so that anything coming through the meter. Have you had anything replaced lately, such as a water heater or water filter system, anything like that?
No, nothing like that.
Because, yeah, like I say, usually a buzz is something in the line that's actually vibrating or fluctuating. The toilet does open the valve fairly far every time it comes on instead of being a partial opening. You might be able to take the toilet valve itself and turn it down about a quarter of the way. Wouldn't want to turn it off. It wouldn't fill fast enough. But if you turned it down just a little bit so it didn't have quite as much water flushing through it, filling quite as fast, it might reduce it. And unfortunately, a buzz like that or a vibration in the water line is very difficult to track down because the hydronics do transmit the sound and the movement throughout the entire water pipe system. It's very difficult to find out where the beginning is.
Well, how urgent is it to find it? Is there any danger or damage involved?
As a general rule, no, there's no significant danger. Worst case scenario, if you had some pipes that were not well supported, we could end up with some fatigue at a joint because the whole pipe is moving. But if the pipe system is properly supported, then it's more of an annoyance than anything else.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for calling in.
Thank you. And I believe we have a caller on line one from Urbana. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes. Good morning. You're on with Scott.
Hello. I have a problem with my driveway. The pavement on the driveway is subsiding relative to the garage, so there's about an inch or so gap there. Is there some way to fix that without having to tear it out and put in new concrete?
Usually, yes. Of course, I can't say yes for all instances, but for the most part, yes. What has happened most likely is that the soil has settled underneath the concrete slab, or what I'll call the apron, which is the first section next to the driveway. This is because it is not on a footing. When they were doing the construction, they probably had to bring in some loose dirt in that area, put the concrete over it, and we've had a little bit of drop or a little bit of settlement. And occasionally they can actually slide away from the garage just a little bit. If it's just dropping to where now you've got a bump going up into the garage, probably the easiest cure is a process called mud jacking or concrete raising, where they can drill a couple holes in the concrete slab and they hydronically pump water and concrete mix underneath it and float the slab back up into place. If it's pulled away from the garage, leaving a gap, they do make some foam backer rods for filling cracks, and then you would pour over a crack filler. Basically, you'd buy a foam plastic piece that would fit down inside the crack and fill most of the crack, and then you cover it with one of the flexible concrete patches. So, there is going to be some movement on that apron. You have to remember the garage slab itself has enough heat from being enclosed that it does not freeze the soil underneath it. But the apron, the soil can actually freeze underneath.
Right.
And so in the wintertime, that apron can come back up. It's amazing the number of garages that have a little bit of damage on the door trim right at the bottom because the concrete slab or the apron lifted during extreme cold and has actually contacted the trim around the door and damaged some of that. So if it's only a couple of, you know, a half an inch to 3/4 of an inch, I probably wouldn't do much about it because it'll come up in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's dropped significantly enough where the car has to grunt a little bit to go up, you get an inch or inch and a half movement, you may want to consider getting that concrete raising. It's a fairly permanent solution. It's something that will last, you know, 15 years, 20 years or so.
Okay. Are there companies around Champaign-Urbana that do this kind of thing?
There are a couple companies. I know of at least one or two of them. I haven't looked in the phone book to see just how many there are. I've used Ross Concrete Raising. I believe we had one in the area called Mud Sharks. Both of them do that type of work.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, we're in the studio with Scott Spies with our monthly home inspection show here on Focus 580. And let's take line two in Champaign. Hello, you're on the air with Scott.
Yeah, hi. The house was built in, I think it was 1979. I have the casement windows, and is there a source for, you know, I have trouble, you know, in terms of cranking out some other, you know, replacement parts. Is there a source for that?
Yeah, there is a couple of different sources. Actually, my father has done some research on things like that and has the name of at least one or two companies that have some window parts. I don't have them here with me in the studio, but if you'd like to give us a call over at our office, area code 217-356-5048, I'm sure Hank will have a name or two that we'll be able to get to you.
Okay, and the other one is, what about people that actually do that work, too? Is there a good source for that, too, or ask your dad at that time?
Well, when it comes to window people, I'll tell you what, there is a shortage of them that do good quality work.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any names that I give out on a regular basis. I used to do that a little bit, and they'd get so much work, they'd get swamped and quit taking business. Basically look for somebody that you can get some references from, somebody that you can check with other people to see what kind of quality work they've done.
Okay.
It is one of those things where you have to love the work to do it correctly. It's not just something that you can just whip in and whip out and get it everything working nicely. It's somebody that has to be willing to spend the time to make sure the windows are put together properly, make sure they're square, make sure that the mechanisms aren't binding, mm-hmm. et cetera. So it is a little tough to find somebody that does good quality window work.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. Again, this is Focus 580, and we have Scott Spies with our monthly topic, home maintenance. And we welcome your calls at 333-9455 or toll-free at 800-222-9455. And we have a caller in line three from Lovington. Hello, welcome to the show.
Hi, I got I put one of these in-wall electric heaters in a bathroom to take the edge off. It's working pretty good for me, but I was just wondering, in practice, do these things, will they generally raise your electric rate or lower it when you get a – I was thinking about doing it in another couple bathrooms.
Well, electric resistance heat is, for the most part, more expensive than most other forms of heat depending on your area. Referring to specifically Champaign and Urbana, the electric rate is high enough to where, yes, an electric resistance baseboard is going to be more expensive to operate than, say, your natural gas system. However, if you get out into the rural areas, some of the smaller towns where we don't have the natural gas and you're running on propane, then it's not necessarily as much of a problem. Electric is 100% efficient in that the energy it uses all transfers into heat, but it is possible that your electric rate is higher than what your fuel rate would be if you were to run a furnace. On, say, LP or natural gas. Conversely, if you're more comfortable by being able to take off a little bit of the chill in the bathroom and you keep the temperature in the house cooler the rest of the time, then it can actually save you money by having the electric heaters. So it kind of depends on how you operate them. If you're trying to use them as primary heat, I would have to say there's a good chance it's going to be more expensive to use. But if you're just using them for supplemental, half an hour in the morning or something like that when you're getting ready, I doubt that it's going to make that much of a difference.
All right. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Again, this is Focus 580 and our monthly topic of home maintenance. We welcome your calls with Scott Spies from Spies Home Inspection Service, 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. If you have questions about things you're thinking about in your house or maintenance issues you might have or just need a little advice about keeping your house and getting it ready for winter, Scott is here with a lot of experience and happy to talk to you. In fact, I think we have lines open. So having said that, on that question, Scott, about the about the auxiliary heater unit.
Mm-hmm.
What's the deal with those in terms of safety? So I've seen these are showing up more and more. You can add this to your bathroom. You can add this in a room for auxiliary heat. Are these safer? I mean, you hear about space heaters being frightening and on all the time. So what's the...
Well, temporary space heaters, one that would plug into a wall and be a freestanding unit, can be a fire hazard, also can be a burn hazard. So the placement of them has to be monitored well. You don't want to put them underneath an electrical outlet and have a cord draping down over the top of it. You don't want to have it right next to furniture. You try not to put it in areas where children are playing or could fall on one. Most of the newer ones now have some safety features built into them with a tip-over shutoff switch. So if they get knocked over or bumped so that they fall face down on the carpet, they do turn off. But anytime we run with one of the temporary units, there is a safety concern. I do believe our caller was referring to one that was permanently mounted in the wall. Most of those are hardwired rather than plugged in so that they've got a better electrical connection, so less chance of heat there. Also, be mounted in a wall, of course, they don't tip over. Still not something I'd want to back up against on a regular basis. But for the most part, the built-in ones are definitely a lot safer.
Fair enough. All right. We are taking line one on Urbana. You're on with Scott Spies.
Yeah, hello.
Hello.
I have some green, perhaps mold, coloring on my cedar shingles in the front of the house, and I was wondering what's the best treatment?
It's probably a moss more than a mold.
Okay, that's good to hear.
It's one of those things where when you've got a wood shingle, wood is a food source for all various different types of plant life. Your best bet is likely to contact some of the guys that do some spraying of I don't want to say an algicide, but that's basically what it is, to coat the shingles. Again, there was a painting company here in town that was doing it for a while, and I cannot off the top of my head remember who it was. When you've got a wood shingle that's starting to deteriorate because of the moisture, we can start getting that moss growing on there, and it will extend the life of the roof to get it sealed or coated with something that will help reduce that plant life. On new construction, when you're putting on a wood shingle, I like to recommend the use of a shingle saver, which is a zinc or copper strip that they'll put up near the top of the shingle when they install it, and let the acidic rain wash the chemicals from the zinc or the copper down the shingle and help act as a barrier or resistance to the plant growth. But if you've already got the green moss, you could probably do a little bit yourself with a mild solution of bleach and water. Will kill off quite a bit. The only downside is if you try to spray it too heavily on the roof and it runs out the gutters and comes out the downspouts, then you end up with a spot in the yard that's not doing too well either.
Well, this is not in the roof. It's the sidings.
Siding? It's okay. Siding.
So I could just spray on some...
You could spray on a water and bleach solution and kill off most of it and not have any real issues as long as you're not dousing it so much that the water is running down and out into the yard. In other words, I'd use more of a garden sprayer than a garden hose.
Right, okay. And what sort of proportions of water and bleach?
Usually it's about a 4-to-1 or 6-to-1.
Okay. That's 4 water to 1 bleach, right?
Correct.
Okay. And I could use the same thing on the cement stoop, which is right below it. Is that right? Because there's some green growing there, which is...
Yeah, and for that, I just put a real light coat on there because this concrete doesn't absorb the water, so it'll tend to run off and want to kill your grass along the edges.
Right.
We get at this a lot on vinyl siding, and I recommend a soft bristle brush, such as one used for cleaning motorhomes or something. You can put it on a hose and a long handle and get up to many areas. On the concrete, after you spray it down, a little bit of a brush with a good stiff brush will probably clean the concrete up quite quickly.
Yep. Sounds great.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And let's go on right to line 2, caller from Champaign County. Hello. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I'm using composite. A material trim, and they have some pretty elaborate instructions about it, but one of the things I noticed was they asked for these kind of special roundhead screws, and I actually bought some really weird-looking deck screws that are two different kinds of threads on them, so there's a bigger thread for holding the composite material and then a better, finer thread for the wood that you're actually fastening it to. And it calls for roundhead screws, but then it asks for them to be flush. So I don't know if I'm supposed to countersink or something. Or
no, you do not want to countersink those screws.
Yeah.
By trying to countersink it, you can crack or fracture the integrity of the composite siding. The composite siding is effectively a concrete siding with a fiber material to help make it stronger so they can make it thin.
This isn't concrete. This is as they said in The Graduate, plastics. This is actually a plastic. It looks just like a piece of wood, only it's very expensive. And I have a story and a half soffit. It's a soffit that's story and a half high. And it's where I've had some ice damming problems that I've brought up with you in the past. And I just kind of wanted to put something up there that would... I wouldn't have to do any maintenance on for quite a while.
Well, the plastic decking or plastic siding and decking is also another good product because it doesn't deteriorate with most weathering. And a little bit of UV damage is about it. But you don't really want to countersink down into it because if you tighten it or stress it in one point, you can actually get some radial fracturing coming out from around the screws and break out a section. So when they say it's supposed to be flush, I'm going to assume that they're talking about the backside of the head of the screw should be flush to the siding and not the top of the screw flush with the siding.
Yeah, that's kind of odd way to put it because that just means you want it tight. So, yeah, it has other admonitions like you can't you don't want to put it close to the edge of the wood, too, which makes your way you're going to fasten it actually a problem in some regards. But are there any other things about it? They generally say a regular carbide rotary saw is fine with it.
Good sharp saw will work much better. It doesn't tend to burn through because either with the concrete or with the plastic composites, we want a good clean cut. We don't want to overheat the areas, which can again cause some stressing or fracturing. So yes, a good bit will make it all the difference in the world is how good a clean cut you can get and reduce any chances of cracking from the edges.
Okay, I guess it's worth a new blade then. Thanks a lot.
All right, well, thank you for calling in.
All right, let's go right on to line 3 in Urbana. Good morning, and welcome to the show.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call. I have about 2 years ago, I noticed a bubble, or I started having a sound coming from one of the toilets in the house, and it was a kind of a bloop, bloop type sound, and it was a air bubble that would come up into the toilet bowl. And it went on for a while, and I didn't do anything about it, although eventually I went and looked up on the roof and looked down the vent stack to see if there's anything stuck in there, and there wasn't that I could see, and then it went away. But then this year it came back again, and it has gotten a little more common. So I'd say we have 10, 15, 20 bubbles a day or something like that. It doesn't seem to be associated with anything else I would do, like anything else running or anything related to plumbing in the house, and there's two other toilets in the house that don't have this problem. So I wonder what you might thought.
It definitely sounds like a plumbing vent issue. Most toilets run what they call a wet vent, where down at the first elbow, they usually take a pipe off the backside and run it out to the venting system. My guess is that you've got something blocking that. We vent the plumbing system so that any back pressures from the sewer system in the house, instead of gurgling or bubbling back up through the trap, will go up and out through the roof area or through the venting system.
Right.
If you're getting a bubble back up through the plumbing vent, or through the toilet rather, if you stop and look how a toilet's built with basically a reverse trap or an S trap where it has a section that goes up and then it comes back down. If you've got enough pressure in behind it to actually push air through it, you definitely have somewhere in the house with a plumbing vent blocked. Or somebody changed the plumbing system to where the vent now has a low spot and holds water in it, and that water can move back and forth. But it would actually take a couple of pounds of pressure, probably 3 or 4 pounds of pressure to actually force an air bubble down that far and back up. Without looking at the system or without getting a plumber out there, there's not much I can tell you what to check other than what you said. You look down in one of the vents. Generally speaking, looking down from the roof will give you little or no information because there's almost always an elbow very quickly either in the attic area or right as it gets down below the plumbing area. So the plumbing vent itself is not a straight through vent. But somewhere you've got a blockage in there that is creating that, and a plumber is going to be the one you're going to need to come out and take a look at it and see if he can figure the problem out.
Okay. Appreciate the information.
Well, sorry I didn't have a quick, easy answer.
That's how it goes.
It's kind of like car talk. Sometimes you get it right. Sometimes you just got to make a guess, apparently. So let's go on right away to caller on line 1, a cell line, I believe. Hello.
Hi, Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is regards ACQ treated lumber and corrosion of metals. I've got a deck with ACQ posts whose dimension I'd prefer not to enlarge significantly, and I'd like to wrap those in brake metal to match the rest of the aluminum-sided house. Is there a means by a film or some other method that I can wrap those ACQ posts so that they could be wrapped in brake metal, aluminum brake metal, without that metal disintegrating?
Most of the time, well, first of all, let me say this is just a little bit out of my area of expertise, but I can touch on the general points here. The treated posts that you're referring to, the chemicals used to treat the post do have some acidity. They do attack some metal, so they do recommend using stainless screws and such. Very rarely do you get enough of the chemical coming out to where it actually starts affecting things that touch it on the surface. Mostly they're worried about fasteners that are going down deep into the wood where we can actually hold the chemical. Painting the surface of the wood would give it a film that would offer some protection for your brake, for your covering metal. Like I said, I'm not an expert on that particular area, so that's kind of just a general knowledge. It's something that we'd have to do a little bit more research on to give you a better answer.
Okay, just to add my two cents to the discussion, I looked online and also have some direct experience with the aggressiveness on the fastener end of it. But online, there were indications from siding association professionals and such that surface contact even would be significant. And I've seen buildings almost fall down on the fastener side of it because of that. So anyway, my impression is that there does need to be an interface. So anyway, I'll look into it further.
All right. Well, I apologize. Like I said, it's not something that most of the treated stuff is deck work, and it's not something that I'm quite as familiar with. But I do know that they have changed the chemicals that they've used for treating the deck lumber for a longer life, and we do have to use special fasteners or we can get some problems with that.
Okay. Thank you much.
All right. Thank you very much. And let's move on right to line two to Sullivan, who's been waiting very patiently. Thank you. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, I had a couple quick questions. A friend of mine has a house. I've helped her with a couple of things, couple of projects. And one thing that we were looking at is it's an old house, probably 100 years old or so. And the bathroom is tiny. It was added on or converted from a pantry or something of that nature. And whenever you're doing things in the bathroom, showering especially, it gets really damp in there. And we're looking at a way to relieve that, maybe an exhaust fan or something like that. And one person we talked to suggested an exhaust fan in the ceiling vented into the attic, and I was wondering if that would possibly cause problems with humidity in the attic space, or if there's maybe a simpler or better way to do that.
Okay, well, first of all, you're probably right. It was my guess is if the house is over 100 years old, it originally had an outhouse, and so the indoor plumbing was something that wasn't considered when it was built. And then
right.
They added on, and usually the first thing to do is take the old back mudroom or back porch and enclose it. You say we have a lot of humidity. Well, anytime you're showering or something, you're putting a lot of moisture in the house. But what I'm assuming is you're referring to it actually condensing on walls and ceilings to where you have a little bit of water film.
Yes.
And that usually means that is one of the coldest areas. Again, when associated with a conversion like that, we're probably missing some insulation. There's probably not as much insulation in the attic, maybe no insulation or very little insulation in the walls around that room, which will give you that the condensation effect because the warm, humid air hits the cold wall, cold ceiling, and we get some condensation.
And so there's not a heat vent in there either.
Well, of course, a no heat vent in an area that has water lines is never a recommended thing. One of the first things I do is consider looking at doing some insulation of the room to try and warm it up so we don't have the condensation. That in itself does not get rid of the moisture, but it does help reduce the condensation you're seeing on the walls. To get rid of the moisture, yes, a vent fan or vent system is recommended. The one you were discussing about venting into an attic, usually on an addition like that, the attic area has very little ventilation. In other words, I doubt that there's a roof vent in that little addition or that little porch area. If we had a bath fan that went into a large main attic area, it's not as much of a problem. But if you try and exhaust a vent fan into a small enclosed space that's cold, yes, you can get mold, mildew, rot, deterioration, collapsing of framing, all sorts of things. Most of the time, particularly on the older houses, the attics are very large, very well ventilated, so I don't worry too much about it if it's going into the main attic. Ideally, we'd like to see it vented out through the soffit or all the way out through a roof vent, because we don't really want to add more moisture in the attic area, particularly in the wintertime where we get the condensation. But if the attic is well ventilated, such as what I usually find in the older construction, such as what you're bringing up, mm-hmm. I wouldn't worry too much about it if it went out to the main attic area. But if it's truly an enclosed porch or an add-on and it meets the wall because the house is two-story and the room where it's at is only one-story, then there's little or no ventilation. So you're going to have to run it all the way through the roof, or you're going to have to run it out through the soffit and drop it down out of soffit area.
Gotcha.
The fan itself doesn't really care whether it's blowing up or down. It will move more warm air out if you if you're blowing up, in other words, out through an attic area. But you can move just as much moisture through by ventilating it down, putting it in a wall and running it down to a crawl space and vent it out through a crawl space if it's easier to get to. So moving the air down and out through a vent would work just as well as far as getting moisture out. Water, once it evaporates, becomes a water vapor and moves according to vapor pressure rather than airflow. So what you're just trying to do is move large volumes of air out so that it helps take that moisture out. It doesn't care whether it's going up or down. If you're trying to get heat out of a bathroom, of course, you want to try and take it up. But for just taking moisture out, yeah, if it's easier to put something in a wall that you can get down to a crawl space and vent it out through a crawl space, that's because I know that a lot of those attic areas on those older homes with converted rooms, there's almost no access to be able to get up into it.
Mm-hmm. All right. And then other quick question I have is there an inexpensive way to insulate the crawl space or even just the ductwork? She seems to lose a lot of heat, between the furnace and the vents.
Okay, that's actually very common. You can lose, I'm going to roughly say, 10 to 15% of your heat loss can be out through foundation walls if you've got a relatively well-insulated house. So in other words, if somebody's already blown insulation into the walls and attic areas, then most of your heat loss that you've got is probably going out through crawl space or basement walls. Anything below, I would say, about 15 inches below grade is not losing a lot of heat, because the soil level is going to stay about the same temperature, roughly about 50 to 55 degrees. But in the top 15 inches of soil and any of the foundation that's exposed above soil level can get colder. So I do recommend insulating foundation walls. Again, a 100-year-old house, we're probably looking at some brick, which may or may not be have good mortar in it. So it's kind of hard to...
Concrete block.
Oh, it is block. Okay.
Yeah.
With a concrete block, usually what I'll recommend is just a polystyrene foam board, an extruded foam board, not a bead board. The extruded boards are usually noted as a pink board or a blue board, whereas the bead board is generally white in color. The bead board can actually hold moisture, whereas the extruded foam boards are a closed cell foam, and they don't hold the moisture. And it's a matter of taking a 2-foot wide board. I think they're available in 2-foot by 4-foot and 2-foot by 8-foot. Or you can buy them in 4 by 8 sheets and cut them yourself. 2 inches would be ideal. If you got an area where you can't get too easily, you can buy it in 1-inch thicknesses, and it'll flex a little bit to go in through smaller holes. Just basically some construction adhesive and glue them right to the wall. It will give you a good insulating barrier. From the foundation wall up, what we call the band joist area, There's usually 10 inches of lumber before we get to the flooring. Just some fiberglass bats. Now, if you put some fiberglass in that area, make sure it is an unfaced bat. In other words, no paper backing on it. We don't want anything to act as a vapor barrier, which would prevent any airflow or any air movement around that band joist area, because we could get some condensation in there. So an unfaced bat up in the band joist area and a extruded foam board from the crawl space walls, from the top of the crawl space walls down approximately 2 feet, should do quite a bit. Then any heat loss from the ductwork in the crawl space will effectively heat the crawl space. Well, crawl space is going to be about 55 degrees if we don't have a lot of cold air coming in from it. And so warming 55 degrees up to 65 doesn't take a whole lot of heat, and warm air does go up, so it'll actually warm the floors and make the house a little bit more comfortable. So ideally, of course, you do want to go through the crawl space, and if you've got any major heat losses from holes in ductwork or ductwork that doesn't fit well, a little bit of tape to seal those would help. Now, interestingly enough, duct tape works well for an awful lot of things, but ducts is not one of them. So if you want to seal any of the metal ductwork, I would use a metallic tape available for most of the heating companies and do-it-yourself stores.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Okay. Yeah, I think you'll see a pretty good improvement by putting a little bit of insulation around those crawl space and foundation walls.
All right. So we are about the three-quarter mark of our monthly talk with Scott Spies about home maintenance. I'm Chris Harris, your host on Focus 580 this morning. We welcome your calls about your home, 333-9455 locally, or 1-800-222-9455. So, Scott, I do have a question, I guess, that I thought about based on, you said, the vapor barrier here. Where do I want a vapor barrier in my house? Where do I not want one? I mean, this is, you know, everything will come with a vapor barrier or not with one, and there's debate. I see people say, oh, you don't want it on that side of the house. You don't want it on the ground. You don't want it. Why do I want one, or where do I want it?
I recommend, first of all, that any crawl space should have a vapor barrier over the top of the soil surface to prevent any moisture from the ground from coming up into the house. It's amazing the number of houses I get into. Everybody says, oh, it's got a really dry crawl space, dusty dry. And sure enough, you go down there and there's a half an inch of dusty dirt. It gets all over your clothes when you try and crawl through it. And I can take a clear piece of plastic, 2 foot square, and throw it down on top of that dusty dry crawl space. And by the time I explain that moisture moves relative to vapor pressure rather than through airflow, et cetera, you turn around and look at that piece of plastic and there's water dripping off the backside of it. You're like, well, you put that plastic in there to create that moisture. No, that is the water that's actually coming up out of the ground and into your house. It's just that it's dry. Your house has ventilated well enough that this moisture is drying out. So first and foremost, any crawl space should have a good vapor barrier, a complete vapor barrier over the top of the soil surface. Not under gravel. We don't want to hold it down. We don't want to ballast it because we want it to be able to float if there's ever any flooding. When you put insulation in a house, the vapor barrier should always be on the warm side of the insulation. So if you're putting insulation into the wall, the vapor barrier should be on the inside between the insulation and the drywall. If you're putting insulation in an attic area, then you want the vapor barrier on the bottom side. Now, if the house already has insulation and you're putting another layer of insulation over the top, you don't want to put a vapor barrier in unless you've got at least 6 to 8 inches insulation on top of that vapor barrier. So if you've got an old home that was insulated in the 80s and has 3.5 inches of fiberglass up there, you don't want to put a paper-backed fiberglass bat on top of it unless you're going 8 inches or more, because we don't want to have any condensation in that insulation. We don't want water getting to the vapor barrier, condensing there, having the insulation blocking the airflow and create a mold and mildew issue in between the layers of fiberglass. So vapor barriers for walls, they're pretty straightforward. If you're blowing insulation in, you can't really put a vapor barrier in. Hopefully the contractor did when it was new. If it was an older house, it probably doesn't. But I doubt that you're willing to go and pull all your lath and plaster off the house to put in a vapor barrier. It'll seal the house up a little bit better. But one of the interesting things I've found over the years is that Tyvek, which is being used as a house wrap on the outside of the houses, is not a vapor barrier. It's a weather barrier, but not a vapor barrier. If you take a piece and hold it out and pour water on it, it won't go through it. But if you breathe through it, you can actually fog a mirror on the other side of it. So the vapor will go through, but liquid will not. They use it for wrapping the exterior of the houses. It was originally intended and designed for putting in attics. They actually put it over the top of the insulation in the attic. Once you insulated your attic with a loose fill insulation, you'd put this wrap or this Tyvek over the top of the insulation. And it was intended to reduce thermal convection through the insulation, which thermal convection would move air through the insulation, and as the air moves through there, it doesn't insulate as well. So to help improve the insulating value of the insulation, they put this house wrap, is what we're calling it now, or basically this weather barrier over the top of it to help reduce how much air moved through it. So again, instead of adding a lot of extra insulation in your attic, you can actually improve your attic insulation efficiency by putting one of the house wraps over the top of the insulation to help reduce some of that thermal convection through there. But that's not technically a vapor barrier, so it can be put on top of the insulation, which means it's easier to install.
I didn't realize. Yeah, you do see that around every place you see it wrapped. That's interesting. So it's not. So Tyvek is not there for a moisture barrier.
No, it's not there for a vapor barrier. It's there for water, for wind. Helps reduce a lot of the airflow through the house. Insulation insulates or reduces heat loss by trapping air. And so anytime we have air moving through the insulation, if we have a fan or something blowing on it, we can lose some of the efficiency. So by putting this wrap around the house, a wrap over the top of the insulation, we reduce the amount of airflow moving through that fiberglass insulation or cellulose and therefore increase the efficiency of it.
All right. Very good. This is Focus 580 this morning, and you're listening to Scott Spies, Spies Home Inspection Service. And to take your calls and questions about maintaining your house, 333-9455 if you're local, or 1-800-222-9455 is the number to call toll-free. Again, Scott, we're glad to have you here, and we appreciate you being in here. And just following up on a question an earlier caller from Sullivan had, the one about ventilating his bathroom, putting an exhaust fan in. So you talked about where to duct it and what it might do and what it might not do. How do you size these things? I mean, if you go – I put this in a couple of years ago in mine, and you go look, and there's just an endless row of these things, that all of which have different claims. So how do I know which one I want to put in and what am I looking for?
Well, you need to size it by the size of the room. They have different CFM, or cubic feet per minute, ratings on the fan and how many zones of air that they move. You know, a bigger fan for a bigger bathroom, a smaller fan for a smaller room. As long as you're willing to run it, it really isn't that critical. I mean, you could put a small fan into a larger room, and it's not going to move as much air through it, but it's still going to take a lot of the humidity out. I really like to see the bathroom fans on a timer rather than a wall switch. That way, when you take a shower, you can turn this timer to, say, 30 minutes or 40 minutes, take your shower. When you leave the shower, the fan continues to run for a short period of time afterwards to help draw more moisture. Because when you're done with your shower and you walk out of the bathroom and turn the light switch off, that doesn't mean we've taken all the moisture out of there. So it's one of those things where for $12 or $14 at the do-it-yourself stores, you can buy a one-hour timer. And so when you turn the fan on, rather than flip a switch, you turn a dial, and then it continues to run for a while. And that helps to pull some of the moisture out of the house.
Very good. Okay, it looks like we have a couple more callers on, so let's get right to them. Line 4 from Onarga, I'm sorry. You're on the air with Scott. Hello.
Onarga?
Yes, that's you, sir.
This is Ron Kahn from Onarga. I have an American Standard dual hunt tank hooked together, and sounds like there's a steady drip all the time, but the water level never changes in the tank, and I can turn the water supply off, and it will continue to drip for a while. Then if I flush it with the water turned off, it finally stops. But the water never raises or lowers.
Okay. Most likely what you've got is just a little bit of a leak at the flapper seal inside the tank, and just a little bit of water is dripping down in through there. It's quite possible that replacing the rubber flap in the tank will fix it. The other possibility is that the float level is just a touch too high, and if you get just a little bit of water going down into the fill tube for the bowl, that we can actually get the water running down in the toilet and dripping into your pipework below. So my guess is one of two things: either the water level is too high, or the rubber flapper in the tank has just a little bit of a leak.
At the lower part of the tank.
Yeah. Here's one quick way of testing it. Go in there when everything's full and everything, all the water is up to the level it should be, and put a couple of drops of food coloring dye into the tank.
Never thought of that.
Dye the water in the tank and then let it sit for an hour or two. And then when you come back, if the water shows up in the bowl, then we have a flap leak. If no water shows up in the bowl, then apparently no of the colored water. I like to use red because it's nice and easy to see, but you can use one of the, you know, depending on the color of the toilet. If you've got a blue toilet, you don't want to use blue food coloring. If you've got white, you can use just about everything except yellow probably wouldn't be the best choice.
No.
One of those things where if you have a leak there, it's very hard to see. If it's overfilling, usually what you'll find is that the streaks of color actually start at the rim and work their way down because the water's coming in
it
from around the rim.
It never shows that it's overfilled at all. It stays at the same level all the time in the tank.
Well, it's supposed to. There's a water valve in there on a float that if the water in the tank starts dropping down, it's supposed to add more water.
I never hear water coming in at all.
Well, if the valve works properly, it probably is only opening enough to just let enough in there to keep it full, and it's not going to take much at a slow drip.
It's just that drip.
Yeah. My guess is that rubber flapper. Like I say, drop a little bit of food coloring in there and see if it doesn't show up in the bowl, and then go out and buy you can buy a new rubber flapper these days for about $8.
So. Oh, yeah. Okay, thank you.
All right, well, thank you for calling in.
You're welcome. Food coloring, brilliant. This is why we have you on the air. And that's probably why our caller on line one from Fisher would like to talk to you just in the few minutes we have left. Hello. Fisher, good morning.
Yes, good morning. I have some plaster that's falling off of an older house that I own. And I'm taking it off of lath and plaster and going to replace it with drywall. My question is, I have a space between the ceiling and the roof that's like 3.5-4 inches thick, and I want to insulate that. Is that advisable, or do I need airflow through that? Any answers?
No, you don't need airflow through that area. If you say between the roof and the attic, so I'm assuming that somebody's dropped the ceiling just a little bit at one point in time.
It's just an older house where the ceiling follows the roof line, which is at a slant, of course, to the ceiling and the roof.
So it's a sloped area.
Yes, correct. Yes.
Okay. Let me revise my answer then. If it's a sloped area and you've got, say, 3 to 4 inches from a roof rafter or something like that, you don't want to fill that area completely with insulation. They make a product called an air chute, which is a styrofoam piece that can be slid out alongside the top of the roof, bottom of the sheathing, which will keep some air moving past the sheathing, and then you can fill the rest of it in with insulation. But if you...
Okay, yeah, I am familiar with those.
Because you're looking at effectively a cathedral or a sloped roof area. If there's no attic space above it, then...
There is attic space, yes.
There is attic space above that. Well, if there's attic space above it, if there's some type of ventilation above the insulation, then
right.
We don't need to worry about it. If you have a blank, a confined space, and there is space above it in the attic, then, yes, you can go ahead and fill your confined space. If you have a confined space and the roof sheathing is in contact with it, in other words, directly over the top of that confined space, no, you don't want to fill it. You don't want to have cold roof sheathing with insulation directly on it. We'll end up with condensation between the insulation and the roof sheathing, and the insulation won't let it dry. But if you've got an air space above it, then, yes, you can go ahead and fill that with insulation. We don't have to worry about it.
So the attic area, which is ventilated, I do have vents in the attic area. As long as that's vented properly, we're okay. I can fill that area on the slope.
Yes, you should be able to, as long as the sloped area is not a direct section of the roof.
Okay, well, yeah, it is. So, in other words, I need to put those vents in.
Yeah, if the area you're trying to insulate has contact with the bottom of the roof sheathing, then, yes, it does have to have some airflow through it. The problem we run into is if you really insulate it well and then you have a warm, humid room, the moisture can move through water. Once it starts moving by vapor pressure, it will move through floors, doors, walls, just about anything except vapor barriers, plastic, glass, things like that. And so if you've got an area, say it's a rafter, on one side you've got drywall, on the other side you've got roof sheathing, if you try and fill that completely with insulation, the moisture vapor will still work through there and try and condense on the cold side. And, of course, we're not getting any air through there, so that water will sit in that insulation when you get mold, mildew, or even some rot on the bottom of the sheathing. So between your insulation and your roof sheathing, you need some ventilation.
And then do I still use a vapor barrier on the inside?
If you are taking off all the plaster so that you can put one up, yes, I would like to see a vapor barrier there.
Yes, yeah, I'm doing that, so, yeah.
Yeah, if you're pulling off all the lath and plaster, then, yes, I would like to see a vapor barrier or a sheet of plastic between the drywall and your wall studs.
Okay. Or ceiling studs. That's wonderful. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
And thank you very much for calling. And we're getting near the very end of our time with Scott's piece. So, Scott, again, thank you for coming in this month for us and taking some calls from our friends out there.
Well, it's always a fun time to come over here, Chris, and get to talking with people. And appreciate all of my callers listening and giving their input and having the questions.
And I think what I've learned from today is that insulation is something you really need to think about very carefully before you put it in or take it out.
It's one of those fun things where I get an awful lot of crawl spaces where the insulation has the vapor barrier on the bottom side, and big red letters right on the bottom of the vapor barrier says, apply this side toward living space, which is, if I'm reading that from the crawl space, means that they should be living in the crawl space, not in the house.
So now you're expecting us to read instructions as well as buy this stuff. I think that's just an outrageous idea.
Yeah, I think the instructions that don't get read the most on home construction are the ones on the insulation and the ones on the shingle wrapper.
Okay, and so again, Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service joined us again, as he does every month, to take our home maintenance questions. We really appreciate him coming in. We certainly appreciate all of you called in this morning. And we're going to have more of Focus 580 coming up in just a few minutes. But first, we're going to take a break for a market update and news from National Public Radio. I'm your host, Chris Harris, in for David Inge. Thank you very much.